From KCRW, I'm Frances Anderton, and this is DNA Design and Architecture. There's a Los Angeles community that does not want to become a design district.
Historic Philippine town is being erased because of this design. We will fight you up to the end. We will not let this design district ordinance be passed in the city council.
Hear about resistance against mandatory design standards in historic Filipino town. And we'll talk with veteran antique dealer Joel Chen and his daughter Bianca about a life in collecting. First up, you can love or hate its cheap, cheerful furnishings, but, quote, if it wasn't for IKEA, most people would have no access to affordable contemporary design. The company has done more to bring about an acceptance of domestic modernity than the rest of the design world combined. That was the conclusion of Icon magazine, writing in 2005. Well, this weekend, IKEA's founder, Ingvar Kamprad, died at the age of 91. He had gone from being the son of farmers in southern Sweden to the world's eighth richest person. Fredrik Karlstrom runs a furniture company called Austere, and he has consulted to brands, including IKEA. He is Swedish, he's based in New York, and we reached out to him and asked, how is his native country reacting to Kamprad's passing?
I mean, I don't think it's a exaggeration to say that Ingvar Kamprad is the biggest entrepreneur that Sweden has ever had, and he has furnished the entire country. Everyone has a relationship with IKEA. He was something as rare as a beloved corporate leader and billionaire, so I think people are feeling quite sad.
And beloved, why exactly? I mean, I'm sure you've read some of the obits, and the obits touch on some of the kind of darker aspects of his past, including his support in his youth of fascist causes, his frugality to the point of cost-cutting to an extreme. But he was beloved. Why?
This sort of notion of why should poor people have to make do with ugly things, and why should beautiful things be reserved for wealthy people? That was the foundation of IKEA, and long before it was fashionable to talk about sort of value-based corporations and value-based brands, IKEA was very much living that, and they have since day one. So I think although there was definitely some blemishes on his path, he was able to kind of explain himself and kind of really admit that he screwed up. But people seem to forgive him.
So let's go back to the biggest part of this story, which is his phenomenal influence on domesticity. You said that every Swede owned something from IKEA. Probably everybody in the Western world owned something from IKEA.
I think he looked at the world, which is obviously changing very much when he grew up, sort of before the First World War. And if you think about furniture back then, it was these things you'd pass down through generations, these expensive pieces of furniture, and the rest was kind of crap. And so I think he looked at, can I cut distribution, can I cut costs in manufacturing and pass that saving on to the consumer? And I think he had a great eye. He had a great eye for design. He had a great eye for what people sort of wanted, and he revolutionized not only the furniture itself, he revolutionized how it came to your house and in the flat pack, and also how we bought and get inspired. I mean, the catalog has many times outsold or outprinted the Bible, so it's, you know, he's had a tremendous impact.
That's an incredible statistic. Is it, in your view, Swedish design? And I ask that because outsiders, non-Swedish people, tend to look at Scandinavian design as sort of inherently well-made, lovely woods, beautifully carpentered, etc., etc. But obviously IKEA products are not that. They are cheap and throwaway.
I mean, I think, you know, when IKEA started really growing in the 50s and 60s, he was sort of really shunned by the rest of the furniture community. He wasn't allowed into the furniture fair. In fact, there's a story of him being smuggled in the back of the car under a carpet because nobody wanted him there. And so he had to go outside of Sweden. In fact, he had to go outside of Scandinavia to have his furniture manufactured. But then in the mid-60s, I think 1964, there was a publication in Sweden that came out with a big study, and they looked at sort of IKEA furniture versus more expensive stuff. And what the study found was that the durability and the sort of quality of IKEA was actually higher than his competition. So that kind of catapulted IKEA into sort of the mainstream. So is it Swedish? I mean, I think it has the roots of democratization of design at its core. But I don't know what Swedish design is anymore. I don't know. I think if it's about being kind of frugal and, you know, trying to making the everyday special and kind of having that, you know, clever way of solving problems, then I think yes. I think that looking forward, IKEA has some challenges ahead. One is that they haven't really embraced online. I'm not sure if that might change now since Ingmar has passed away. I know he wasn't a huge fan of it. He wanted people to come to the stores, so maybe that will change. And the second thing, to your point with younger people and sustainability, perhaps IKEA needs to think about how can they make more durable things? How can they make sort of fewer, better things, going back to kind of its ethos?
You did do some consulting in the past for IKEA. Did you enjoy working with the company? Was there a kind of IKEA, kind of very strong character to working there?
IKEA has a tremendously strong culture, bordering on sort of religious. And I think people who work there really embody the values that were instilled. I mean, Ingvar wrote this sort of manifest, I think it was in 1976. It's called The Testament of a Furniture Dealer, which outlines sort of 9 principles of the company, which is, you know, to create a better everyday life for the many people. He talks about the IKEA spirit, reaching good results with small means, simplicity is a virtue, never being satisfied. And people at IKEA, from the chairman down to the person at the checkout register, really embodies this. And I think that's why they're so successful.
That was Fredrik Karlstrom, founder of Austere Furniture Company, reflecting on the death of IKEA founder Ingvar Kamprad. You're listening to DNA. I'm Frances Anderton. Now, if you hear the term design district, what comes to mind? Maybe a neighbourhood of fashion boutiques, fine art galleries and furniture and lighting showrooms like those lining Melrose Avenue, Robertson Boulevard and Beverly Boulevard in the West Hollywood Design District. Well, it turns out that the northern part of the LA neighbourhood Westlake, located between Echo Park and Koreatown and encompassing MacArthur Park, is slated to become a design district. At least that's the vision of Councilman Mitch O'Farrell and his planning team. But not everyone is happy about this idea. Jennifer Swan is a contributor for Curbed LA, and she's been following the story. Hello, Jen.
Hi.
Could you tell us, where is Westlake? Is it an enclave that's full of design boutiques?
It is not, absolutely not. Quite the opposite. It's a very diverse neighborhood. You have Tommy's Burgers, the original hamburger stand, the Bootleg Theater is over there. So there's lots of small businesses in this area. Not quite design-oriented. There's a lot of restaurants, there's social services, there's parks, public schools.
So what is this design district concept?
It would basically be a renovation of 3 different major streets in the neighborhood, and that's Temple Street, Beverly Boulevard, and 3rd Street. And the idea is to create a more walkable neighborhood. So they're proposing things like pedestrian bridges. They want to relax requirements for parking. And they say that this will help promote small businesses, get more people on the street, encourage mixed-use construction. And it's really part of this broader agenda to rezone LA toward pedestrians instead of cars. That's how they're billing it.
But people are not very happy about this. And why not?
Yeah, people are pretty riled up about this. Part of that is that they feel that Mitch O'Farrell's office never approached them about this ordinance. They felt that this plan would not include their voices or their preferences for the neighborhood as longtime tenants. Feeding into that opposition is the fact that, you know, this ordinance initially included lots of restrictions. Some of those restrictions were about which businesses could and couldn't be in the neighborhood, right? So an earlier draft of this ordinance said that, you know, if you're an auto repair shop, if you're a car wash or a bail bonds or a drug and alcohol rehab facility, you couldn't go into the neighborhood.
You also read that a nice bakery was warmly welcomed.
Right, right. So initially there was this list of businesses that they suggested. Here are the kind of, you know, businesses that we would like to court in this so-called design district. And those included, as you said, bakeries, cafes, bike shops, all of these things that you might think of when you think of...
hipster neighborhood.
Exactly, yeah. So I think this initial draft of the ordinance fed into these stereotypes about what we think of when we think of gentrification and displacement.
Okay, so the pedestrian-oriented piece sounds like not such a bad idea, but there's kind of a level of control of the aesthetics that's part and parcel of this. Is that right?
Yeah, so there's quite a few proposed requirements that would take place under this ordinance, and these requirements are just for new businesses. They would like for all of these businesses to have the same kind of signage, and they're suggesting custom wooden signs, metal signs that are carved out with these business names in them. What they don't want is these big marquees that you see on strip malls. They don't want signs in front of businesses that are backlit and these neon signs that if you drive through the neighborhood now, you'll see these kinds of signs everywhere. They're pretty ubiquitous. So a lot of these changes they're proposing are drastic in terms of aesthetics. So I went to a meeting last Wednesday night organized by the Coalition to Defend Westlake, and that is sort of this grassroots group spearheaded by the LA Tenants Union. They tend to be very anti-development, very pro-tenants' rights. One of the moderators at this meeting was Susan Hunter. She's with the LA Tenants Union, and she explained some of the proposal requirements.
So the design district will also mean that small businesses are going to have to put in murals or green screens. If you have a front-facing wall 20 foot or greater, you have to have a mural or green screen on it.
Okay, did I understand this correctly? A mural is now mandatory or some kind of planting? So we've gone from a time where murals were banned to now a mural is mandatory.
Yeah, so you're following this. The green screen is basically, you know, they're suggesting that these businesses have these walls of foliage or a mural. The other odd thing about this requirement for murals is that, you know, the city says a mural is defined by something that doesn't have any kind of commercial message, right? So they're asking these businesses to have murals painted on their walls. We're not quite sure who's paying for these murals. They haven't addressed that. But, you know, if you're a bike shop, you can't advertise that you sell bikes.
You just quoted Susan Hunter. She's with the LA Tenants Union, which has been behind fights across LA against development. So is the issue here really one about development?
Yeah, there's a lot of different issues. I think it's what makes this so complicated is that there's this worry, of course, of gentrification and displacement. There's this worry of cultural heritage in the neighborhood. And then there's this question of, is it just anti-development?
Right. You just brought up cultural heritage. And this is a piece of this story.
Absolutely. So these three streets that they're proposing this design district would be incorporated to, it's historic Filipino town. Filipino American activists fought for decades to get this neighborhood designated. It meant so much to them. And so to them, it feels like to slap a new name on it as North Westlake and to rebrand it, you know, people worry, is this sort of an erasure of our history? Arturo Garcia, he's lived in the neighborhood for years. He was on the historic Filipino town neighborhood council, and he spoke out at the meeting and got very fired up about this issue.
Our place is called historic Filipino town, but historic Filipino town is being erased because of this design. Because you call it design, but you are removing the heritage of our district, because it's our only district with historic Filipino town in its name, and if you will erase it, I do not know what will happen. We will fight you up to the end. We will not let this design district ordinance be passed in the city council. We promise you that.
This design district is certainly a provocation.
Yeah, I think that's an understatement. And I think, you know, city planners regret that this name is causing controversy. They said that wasn't the intention. Patricia Diefendurfer is another city planner who was at this meeting. And she says that it was never intended to be a design district in the way that, say, West Hollywood, you know, their design district was. She says that the word was really just a way to address the design aspects of the building,
which is design standards related to parking, driveways, how you treat the ground floor from a design perspective. It was not intended to deal with what kinds of uses are allowed or prioritized in this area. That was not the intention.
Is there anyone in the community that supports this?
You know, there actually are. One of those is this woman named Jocelyn Giga Rosenthal. She's one of the founders of the Historic Filipino Town Improvement Association. She says her family has lived in the neighborhood for more than 50 years. And to her, the ordinance would really create safer streets. So it would alleviate the automobile, which she sees as the enemy.
This ordinance will help develop street-level businesses, pedestrian-friendly edifices that will encourage me and my neighbors to walk at night to the coffee shop on Gigi's. I live five blocks away. Right now, you know, I wouldn't do that in the nighttime. I do in the daytime.
Community activists and business owners are really split on this ordinance. It really depends who you ask. One thing that's sort of a challenge for activists is that the neighborhood does not have distinct architecture in the way that Little Tokyo or Thai Town has these very distinct markers. So one person who brought that issue up is Rianne Estrada. She's the creative director of Public Matters. It's a group that goes into the community and creates art and design projects that's really oriented around civic engagement.
You go to K-Town, signs are in Hangul. You're like, oh, okay, I get it. It feels like you're in a different country. It's not the same.
She's a visual artist. You know, she's a big advocate for design. And on the other hand, she understands why people are upset about city planners coming into their neighborhood.
One way that you can mitigate the harms of displacement is to show that you are indeed investing in the people who are already there. What kinds of, you know, incentives can you give to support local businesses? What kinds of incentives can you do to preserve the places that the community members use? Because those places, even if they're not architecturally significant or design fabulous, actually have meaning for the community, and that meaning has value.
It's really an interesting dilemma. I love her phrase, design fabulous.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Fending off design fabulousness. So what's the status of this project?
Yeah, so this project is still in flux. City planners insist that there's no concrete timeline, that they're very open to hearing more input from the community, and they say that they will be planning additional workshops and fielding feedback in the coming months.
Well, Jen, what a fascinating story. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Jennifer Swan is a contributor to Curbed LA. She's currently working on a feature about the history and future of the five Asian Pacific Islander districts in Los Angeles. I'm Frances Anderton. You're listening to DNA. After this break, Joel Chen just cannot stop collecting.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
Back with DNA, I'm Frances Anderton. Los Angeles is full of people who buy and sell furniture and decorative arts, but one of the most admired, perhaps, is this man.
I'm Joe Chen. I own a gallery, J.F. Chen, on Highland Avenue, and I've been dabble with this business for close to 40 years.
Dabble. Now, that's quite a word. how many pieces about do you have in the showroom that we're sitting in right now?
I'm not very sure, but certainly in the thousands and thousands.
Joel Chen owns three spaces on Highland that add up to about 65,000 square feet. We're in one of them, and in every direction you can see chairs, tables, sofas, armoires, sculptures, and odd artifacts. But it's not just stuff. This is a huge and eclectic collection of carefully chosen and carefully staged objects that began around 40 years ago with a quest for Chinese antiques.
When Chinese antique went out of vogue, I have to make a living, so I venture into painted Italian furniture. I went to English Regency furniture. And back maybe 25 years ago, I went into mid-century. So I was dabbling in 30s, 40s, 50s, and all the way to the 80s furniture.
Now Chen is thinning his collection by a tiny amount. Later this month, 370 or so of his prize pieces will go on sale at Christie's Auction House in New York. Among the objects included, a Sam Maloof rocking chair, an 18th century Chinese blue and white lotus vase, a Carlo Mellino chair, a desk lamp by Greta Magnusson Grossman, and two vases by Ettore Sotsas of Memphis.
I give them carte blanche, and they select what they think is appropriate. And also, it's a mix, just like the store, you know.
Chen says he's very flattered by Christie's interest, but this validation comes as no surprise to his longtime followers, who include interior designers, museum curators, and individuals, from the late Gene Kelly and Elizabeth Taylor through to Moby, Justin Timberlake, Adele, Robin Williams, and Kanye West. West, it turns out, is a self-described lover of furniture.
He has very good taste, and he likes 40s and 50s French furniture. For instance, he likes the designer Jean Royer. We also have Ellen DeGeneres. Impeccable taste. And everything she collected was, may I say, correct, because it went up in prices.
Okay, I'd love to go down the road of celebrities and what they buy from you, but let's just go back to when you start, because now you know what is correct. But when you started, you didn't know what was correct. That was an acquired education. Is that right? Tell us your origin story.
I was driving on Melrose one day, and there was an antique shop. I spotted in the window, very attractive, all the Chinese antiques. And I stop and I knock on the door, and the proprietor waved at me, gesturing no, and I keep knocking, and he finally opened up. He said, the shop is for to the trade only. I said, what do you mean to the trade? He said, architects, interior designers, and obviously you are not one. So I took it as a racist gesture, which I, now you think back, I don't think so. But anyway, I went back furious to my father. I said, I want to open an antique store just like that. And that's exactly what I did. I opened right behind him. When I first started, I didn't understand a thing about antiques. I just stumbled and went to Hong Kong with $6,000 borrowed from the bank, and I had a whole container full in those days of pure Chinese junks. So that's how I started, and I gradually learned from fellow dealers, especially those on Melrose Place.
You said that you started with the Chinese artifacts, and then you moved into a wide, eclectic range. Did you grow up with Chinese artifacts?
Not really. My father was a jeweler, a wholesale jeweler in downtown Los Angeles. I worked for him briefly. I hated it. It's very cutting throat. So that's also why I went to antiques.
You bought your box of Chinese junk and then you started your kind of education. Now, fast forward, 40 years, the Chinese market is huge.
Well, let me say that had I retained all the pieces that I bought prior to the new middle class now in China, it would be a huge, huge fortune. With that, pieces are hard to get now. Everybody's out looking.
Do you still go on buying trips, or do you now find stuff on the internet?
Well, now it's all done electronically, yes. I have less journey to foreign lands, a lot less. I used to go to Slovenia. I used to go to Prague, Czechoslovakia, Hungary, Budapest, the Eastern Blocs. So with the advent of internet, there is no secret. Prices are all very even. There is no bargain. So the internet is good and bad, but we can purchase something in 3 minutes.
But has something been lost in terms of the excitement of the hunt?
Absolutely, yes.
With the nature of the business changing, Joel Chen gets support from the next generation. He has two daughters, Fiona and Bianca. And Bianca currently helps run the business. So what was it like, we asked her, growing up with her design-obsessed father?
Growing up was difficult in the sense that I couldn't touch things at home. Certain rooms I wouldn't have my friends sit in because I didn't want to ruin anything. So I learned to be very careful. But at the same time, I grew up with a really amazing looking bedroom. I had a canopy bed. I had a sofa that we still have that they just reupholstered. A very nice cerused oak dresser. But I didn't care. All I wanted was to put up my Depeche Mode posters on my walls, and he would not let me. No tape on the walls. And I had a comforter that I couldn't sit on, like a duvet, because I couldn't ruin the fluff. But because I couldn't touch a lot of things, I was like kind of walking on tiptoes. I hated the business. I was like, I would never do this. I can't touch anything. I don't know why people would buy this. So I kind of went in my own direction, which was hotel management, and couldn't take that either. But realized that so many of them were also my father's clients, these hotel people. And I would see pieces they would buy from us in like the lobby or like in the rooms. And I said, there must be something like great about this. I mean, it looks great. So after, 8-9 years in the hotel industry, I was like, I think I'm ready to learn and to hopefully learn his taste and his eye and go through design and see what's out there.
Do you think you can learn an eye?
No, not fully, but I do know he's taught me what can sell, the history of things, the education is invaluable. And I think that's what we're lacking now is the education of design. I think the new generation is really liking new things, shiny things. They don't understand why a vintage piece may cost $10,000.
Chen's space jammed to the gills with pieces that he loves and, in his words, speak to each other, is far from the minimalist purity that is a signifier of affluence today. Does Chen ever feel a pull to purge himself of all this stuff?
I definitely had that urge of minimalism, although I'm known to be more is more. Economically, I don't think it works for me. But that also the problem is the what people call the sickness in my brain, which is constant buying. So I have to stop buying. I need a doctor for that, but I don't know if I can be cured.
There was antiques dealer Joel Chen and his daughter Bianca talking about his life in objects. And a sale of them takes place at Christie's later this month. See our website for details. I'm Frances Anderton. That's it for today's DNA. Avishai Artsy is the show's producer. JC Swatek mixed this episode. Thank you very much for listening.